Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So regular visitors to the monastery may notice an extreme lack of, well, I shouldn't say lack, there's a lot of space, extra space. I may have counted wrong, but 11 community members are away, and one is not feeling well. And so yeah, it's a very much reduced crew here in terms of the resident community, and most of them are up in eastern Washington State at a hermitage there. Ajahn Pasno and one of the other monks will be returning on Thursday, and then the rest will be from there will be returning on, we think, Saturday evening. And then Ajahn Yetiko, Ajahn Kundamo are down in the Bay Area tonight for the Berkeley First Tuesday monthly gathering there. One monk has gone today to visit his family in Arizona. So a lot of people away. So all of my senior brothers have left me in charge, sort of. What I like about this tradition is that whoever ends up sitting in this seat, it's not personal. It's just who's the next down in line. If I, this afternoon, fell ill, then Tenkasapo would be sitting here, and I see him smiling. So it's not a smile of, yeah, I want to do that. And then if he wasn't here, Tenchunda would be sitting here, so and so on and so forth. And I like that. It's the impersonal nature of this tradition. It's not, doesn't have to do with who can give a good talk, who can chant. It's just who's next in line. So if I were to form, or any of us were to form an identity around sitting here, we wouldn't be following the teachings of the Buddha. We would be going sort of against the grain of the Buddha's teachings. But it's easy to do. It's the habit of our conditioning as human beings to sometimes form identities or around just about anything. We can form our identities around positive things as well as negative things, negative perceptions of ourself or others. This evening at tea time, there was some really, I was really inspired by, you know, so many different questions, so broad ranging. Some of them I wasn't able to answer, I felt, but that's good for me. That's helpful because it makes me investigate further and more deeply, and to look at things, and also to hear other people's reflections on it. I found it extraordinarily helpful. It's that give and take of Dhamma discussion. But yeah, one of the questions came up around self and soul and not self, you know, that concept which is so much a probably in a way, the way I see it, the biggest aspect of the Buddha's teachings. And for most people, I think the hardest to grasp, to see through, to come to an understanding in the heart and to be peaceful with. And one of the aspects of that which I've been really focusing on, well, for the last few years, but especially since the beginning of our winter retreat, which began in the beginning of the first days of January and carried through to the end of March, and my main focus was just trying to get a handle on bhava tanha, or the craving for to become something, or the craving for identification around some state of being. So in the Pali language, it's bhava, which has been translated as so many different things. Becoming is one translation. Being is another. Existence. Taking birth in a particular realm of existence. There's and many more. But the usual translation that we tend to come across in our tradition is becoming. And I've done some reading on this. I've been, you know, trying to balance it between investigating my own experience and of life, both present and past. But then also, you know, balancing it with study. You know, looking at texts, looking at different elders who have reflected on this and put it into books and talks. And it's interesting because Ajahn Tanisaro points out in one of his books on this that the Buddha himself didn't really explain what he meant by bhava, which I didn't realize. And assuming that's correct, and I really trust Ajahn Tanisaro. He's very extraordinarily well studied and considers what he says. And because I kept coming up, what does bhava mean? What does the Buddha mean by that? And I kept not being able to find a good definition. And Ajahn Tanisaro's words saying, well, actually, the Buddha didn't really fully explain it. That helped explain maybe my confusion or lack of finding the answer that at least I wanted. So. But the way I do understand it, and this is, you know, through these investigations, is that it's that sort of, you know, craving or ambition to form an identity around any sort of state of being. So whether it's a social position, you know, or a job, or a personality, or our actions, what we do, or even what we acquire, forming an identity around things that we can get, material things. iPhone 10, or I know it doesn't exist yet, but it will. Or clothing, or, you know, or states of being, or a job, you know, I've got the job. And then we start to form an identity around it. Or around, you know, almost the opposite, like, oh, I'm hopeless. I'm a useless person because I can never get the right job. Or around social position of some sort. Or even in monastic life, you know, oh, now I'm a monk. To form an identity around that instead of just seeing it as a conventional, or a, you know, a conventional truth, a convention. This is a monastic convention. Being a doctor is a medical convention, societal convention. Being a train driver, whatever it is. But it, so it's that sort of any kind of forming any kind of identity, and then attaching to that identity. Because when we as we learn from the Buddha's teachings, if we attach to anything, even wholesome things, if we form a sense of self, a sense of identity around that, as soon as that's challenged, then there's a very good chance or possibility of stress and suffering. And even if it's not challenged yet, we can feel protective. You know, if you're the king of the mountain, you want to keep that, then you might feel threatened as soon as somebody approaches your mountain. So we get the perfect job, and then we think, yeah, if I make a mistake, I'm going to lose this. So we might do things to protect ourselves which are maybe unwholesome. And even if they are wholesome, if there's always that feeling, that background program running, that because of your identification with that position, that you'll be some sort of lesser person by losing that position, then that's a clear sign that we're really identifying with what we are doing, that whatever position that is. Or around material things, if we get the iPhone, whatever, 5, 6, and then 2 years down the line, we feel, you know, lesser person because we can't get the new one. I know it sounds silly, but this happens. You know, or even around material things, you feel like you're not cool, you're not with it, you're not. Maybe somebody will perceive you as not being able to keep up. Maybe, oh, well, that person there doesn't have enough to purchase the new thing. I mean, why do people stand in line for 3 days before buying a new gadget? If they just wait 3 days and get it online, get delivered to their house. Gotta be the first. Gotta get the right job. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't try to get a great job or be good at what we do or to be, you know, to get a good education, to take up the monk's or nun's life and do the best we can with that. But it's that forming an identity around it and grasping that and not really seeing it for what it is, that's where the suffering starts to really, really kick in, the stress, that unsatisfactory nature. And so in the teachings of the Buddha, there's the model or the teaching that the Buddha gave called dependent origination. It's the Four Noble Truths that he taught, but expanded out into a longer version. And I won't go through the full thing, but it begins with a mind and heart of ignorance, the mind that doesn't understand truly the way nature works, the true reality of in particular the human condition. And then it goes through how that ignorance colors how we operate as a human being. So the next one down the list is sankhara. It colors how we form our habits, our habitual thinking, and the habitual ways that we see and perceive things. So sankhara, and then it goes into consciousness. So where we place our focus. You know, through ignorance, we view things through the eyes, we hear things through the ear, smell through the nose, taste through the tongue, touch with the body, and think with the mind. It's all colored through ignorance. And then that passes on they talk about the body, namarupa, the body and mind complex, so that's also with consciousness, how it affects the body and the mind, what we do with ourselves, what we think, what we do with our bodies. And then the next one is the sixth sense bases, how we focus them, where we look, what are we going to listen to, what are we going to do with our senses. And then those things are all just part of being human, but they're the aspects of being human that we're using through that filter of ignorance, which was the beginning in this case. But then after that, we have contact, you know, through those six senses, we have contact. And after that, it gets really interesting. And we start to feel. Where there's contact, there's a feeling, either a pleasant feeling or a pleasant unpleasant feeling, or something neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And then depending on that, it's possible that if that ignorance carries on, if we don't see what we're doing, then some form of desire, craving, unwholesome desire, craving will start to kick in. And it's said, it's said not just by the Buddha, but by so many of the great masters of past, that once feeling kicks in, that's the real opportunity for us to sort of put a ceasing, insert ceasing within that chain of causality that I was talking about, happens when there's feeling. That we don't, that's where the biggest opportunity to choose, choose skillfully or unskillfully happens. So whether we pick up that craving or whether we can just let it lie with feeling. But from craving, then you have that feeling of desire. And then if you start to feed that, we go into the next chain, is upadana, which is either clinging or adding fuel to that desire, sustenance. The word upadana also means fuel and sustenance. And so a bit like feeding a fire. You know, you've got the spark, but if you might have a little fire, but it'll burn out pretty quickly if you don't add fuel. So the same with craving. If you've got this little fire of craving, if you don't add fuel, it'll die right there. But if you add fuel, yeah, you get a fire. So, and that's where, after clinging, after adding fuel, that's usually where we're, that desire and that clinging together, that's where we get to bhava, to that trying to become or get something, either get something that makes us happy. We want to become happy. We want to become a certain personality. We want to be seen as such and such of a thing, be seen as a certain type of person, or be seen as not a type of person. I mean, how many times do we hear, either in our own minds or in other people, oh, I don't want people to think of me as being X, like greedy, or I don't want to be seen as an angry person, or I want to be known as a kind person. I mean, the list is endless, what the mind can throw up in terms of how it wants to conjure itself, as how we want to conjure ourselves as a human being. So here we are, we've got this desire to become, and then within the list of dependent origination, that's immediately followed by jati, or what's translated as birth. And where there's birth, we're told, then there's the sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, because whatever is born is of the nature to die. And that's whether it's a physical thing, a physical being, or a psychological state. Psychological birth and death. And psychological birth and death, we're told, and when you actually, I know from looking at it within my own experience so far in life, is that, yeah, it can happen incredibly fast. Multiple times a day, probably multiple times an hour, probably much quicker than that, because the mind works so fast. And while I've been contemplating this, I was reminded in my own life of a situation back in the late 1990s where it was so clear that I died and I was born psychologically within about 3 minutes in a very, very obvious way, at least to me. The person that who was in the room with me didn't realize. And actually, at the time, I didn't realize myself. This is one of these cases where I feel blessed with learning from my past. As many or some of you know, I was a professional ballet dancer, and then I became a teacher, rehearsal director with a large company in England. And I stopped dancing in 1994 and then retrained as a teacher, formally. I got a diploma in teaching and was immediately hired back with the same ballet company back in England as a teacher. And I had two positions in the same company. And in England, they have a lot of job security, especially if you've been, at that time, if you've been in your job for more than 2 years. you've been in your job less than 2 years, there's a less job security. But 2 years was it was very difficult for them to just let you go without any compensation. And then just before my 2 year period was ending, and I was very much attached to my jobs, I loved my work, and I was very much attached to the prestige of being with this very large, respected dance company. And the perception in my own mind was that I was doing well. People were appreciating me. I was youngish addition to the team. And then one day I got called into the director's office, and she asked me to close the door behind me. And this is a person who never used to close her door. And I thought, And so I closed the door and I sat down slightly on edge. I don't think I even sat back in my seat. And she started talking about cuts in staff. Oh, you know, we're having government cutbacks on our grants, and we're having to cut back and cut such and such amount of people, and we've had to let so-and-so go. And I was dying. Psychologically, I was sitting there. I was dying. All my puffed up feeling of ego, of being associated with something prestigious and that I loved, I was attached to what I was, my attachments were keeping me bound and identified with that job, with that position. And so my mind was saying, okay, I'll move back to California. I'll take up monastic life. I'll go to Abhayagiri. Abhayagiri just opened last year. And maybe I'll become an Anagarika. I'll become a monk. I'll give this all up. I mean, it's giving me up. I'll pack it in. And this is a good sign. And so my mind is doing this all in the background while this woman is talking to me. And so I was, you know, I was dying, but then I was also simultaneously being born as a monk. I was grasping or reaching this ambition to become a monk. Good ambition, and I like that. However, there was suffering, there was stress. So she's continuing, and then all of a sudden she looked at me, and I was for sure. I just thought, okay, this is it. And then all she said, yes, we've had to let this particular person go, and because of that, we want to give you the position of company teacher, which was a big, big promotion for me. That would have been seen as a big promotion. And so all of a sudden I was born as company teacher. And there was this joy and reattachment to my position at English National Ballet. And this all happened within no more than 5 minutes. And that's no exaggeration. So the memory of this came up. It's come up a few times over the last years, because at the time, even though I was into Buddhist, I was practicing Dhamma, or, you know, learning to, you know, the practice of Buddha Dhamma, I really hadn't picked up this teaching yet, picked up this incredibly important teaching. And so now I can see that it was clearly how fast we can pick up suffering and joy. We can just bounce back and forth, you know, this sort of tennis game between happiness and unhappiness. And it was all based on attachment to an identity. I was so identified with being a teacher, ballet teacher, prestigious company. And then immediately trying to fill that, you know, that perceived ending of that, to fill that with something else. Even though what I was thinking of filling it with was, I consider extraordinarily wholesome, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. But still, it was the mind. It's more looking at how the mind And then where did my monastic life go when she said, company teacher? Monastic life got put on hold for another 5 years. And then I was able to put down that life and on my own terms and move forward to this. But then we can attach to this. We can, you know, oh, now I'm a monk. And if we start to form an identity around that, that is seen through with ignorance, seeing it as something real and solid and true instead of just conventional reality. It's a convention, and which I think all of us could hopefully agree, we'll probably agree that it's skillful if we use it correctly. It can be used, it's a skillful model, a skillful way of living, if used correctly, if used the way that the Buddha taught, or to undertake 8 precepts, if we use those skillfully. But if we identify ourselves as, whoa, I took the 8 precepts, you know, and then you go into Ukiah and look at somebody else and go, I bet they didn't take the 8 precepts. Actually, not sure. Maybe they did. Maybe they're living on 8 precepts. We don't know. That's the thing. We don't know what other people are doing. So here again, it doesn't mean that we don't do these things, don't become even ballet teachers or teachers, doctors, whatever we are, bus drivers, you know, anything. It doesn't mean that we don't do that. It just means that we try to see it with through knowing. So instead of ignorance, then the opposite of that is seeing through the lens of Dhamma, seeing through the lens of seeing that if we are grasping, then suffering, stress, unsatisfactoriness is pretty sure to follow. Not understanding the cause of that, so the second noble truth being the cause, so the cause of that is grasping it at either sense. So in the Buddha's sermon where he first talked about the Four Noble Truths, the cause of suffering being grasping at sense pleasure, but then the second one is grasping at becoming, bhava tanha. So this is what I've just been focusing on, is grasping at becoming, identifying with some state of being. And then the third one that he mentions is vibhava tanha, which is identifying with getting rid of. So if I say, oh, I want to get rid of, I've got a lot of things that I need to get rid of so that I can become peaceful. That's another form of grasping, because you're identifying as somebody who has, and then you think that by becoming somebody who doesn't have those. Now, that doesn't mean we don't try to maybe get rid of our habits, but it's just in terms of the identification. I know Ajahn Sumedho, he one of his teachings that he keeps repeating over and over again is, That inner voice that says, I'm somebody who has this right now, and if I get rid of it, for me to become something in the future, I need to do this. I need to get rid of this or get that sometime in the future. And then I'll be happy, or then I'll be peaceful. So on a conventional level, that might be true. Maybe there's habits that we should drop. But if as soon as we're forming that I, that sense of self, that I am, not just linguistically, but in the heart. No, I am. I really am. Really, really am this, whatever it is, wholesome, unwholesome, neutral. If you really hold that to be true and sure and forever, then that's forming a self-identity. And the more we invest in that, the more we buy into it, then, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, if that's challenged, especially if it's something wholesome and something you want to be, I want to be seen as a kind person. I noticed in myself, you know, just sometimes moving around and going to stay different places over the years. I haven't lived in many places as a monk, but I've noticed this kind of subtle, you know, desire to not You know, and I go, even if I go to stay in a monastery just for a couple of weeks, to I don't want to make a mistake. Now, that doesn't mean I'm promoting us wanting to make mistakes or cause disharmony where we go, but I can notice this sort of, you know, instead of just being content and satisfied with, you know, acting as appropriately as I know how, but not worrying. It's that worry, it's that stress. Oh, I don't want to be seen as, you know, doing, I don't want to do something wrong. Even though something wrong might be just, you know, maybe you don't bow at the right time as they do it. I mean, how evil is that? Oh, here they pick up their alms bowls after they do this or whatever. Or after they sit down, they do this at the mealtime. I mean, these are, you know, people won't look at you and say, oh, bad person, bad monk. But I could just, this little subtle, you know, not wanting to, instead of just, yeah, trying our best, trying whatever it is, you know, just trying, doing our best, and then letting go. And becoming, you know, this bhava, and how it, in the chain of dependent origination, how it leads to birth. So looking at, I've been talking about the psychological births and deaths and how we form that. And then it can be looked on in the more cosmological or looking at it in terms of, if we want to look at it in terms of past life, present life, and future life. And that came up today at tea time as well, and as one of the questions really. And I cannot see my past lives, and I cannot see into the future. I don't have that ability. And so I do really feel that those things are real, but it's a belief. I don't know. I can't see for myself. I can't remember past life, and I can't project into the future. But just looking at this lifetime, like for instance, this example I gave of my life at that ballet company and that particular incident, that I can look at. I can look at, I can see that, how the psychological becoming and then the death of that can happen. And it only makes sense that, you know, if that habit of becoming and attachment and clinging, if that carries on, it isn't understood, isn't seen through, isn't let go of and dropped, then it just makes total sense to me that, you know, when the death of this body occurs, where that psychological energy, whatever it is, whatever that life energy, that consciousness energy, whatever it is, and I can't explain exactly what it is, where does that go? You know, if that craving, that clinging is still going on, and what we're told is that that is what will lead us on to another rebirth in another physical realm, be it human or animal or some other seen or unseen realm. Not sure. So it makes sense to me. I mean, just on the, you know, just looking at it, I think, yeah, I mean, I see it in this life. And, you know, it's like I was describing as well at tea time, that a couple of days ago I was sent a photograph of myself and three of my buddies back in the photograph. I think it was probably taken in around 1970 or 71. I would have been 10 or 11 years old. And there we all were, we little hippie kids with our long hair and kind of looking, and our bell-bottoms, first time bell-bottoms came around, okay? Not the third time retro fashion, but the first time, as far as we're aware. And our long hair, and it brought back really interesting perceptions. And then I showed the picture to a few of the monks that were in the office near the computer, and I said, well, which one's me? And it was really hard. Some of them couldn't figure it out, and some were, it's either this one or that one. I think it's that one, and some of them got it right, some of them didn't. And I find that quite interesting, Because for me, I look and I go, oh, that's me. That was me then, and I'm the continuation of that. But how many things have I become since then? How many little micro and mini and medium and large births, psychological births, have I had in deaths? Oh, after that I became a ballet dancer, and then a ballet teacher, and then I became a monk, and then you become something else. So what am I? What are we? I became a British citizen. Am I British or am I American? I have two passports. But these are just, conventional realities. Even that I find quite useful. It's like, that sort of having two identity papers. They say, oh, this is your identity. Well, on a conventional level it is. And a very useful one. Very useful. It means I can go live in monasteries in Europe without any problem. Come back here, no problem. But if I identify with being American, or if I identify and say, oh, now I'm British. So if I start going around saying, I'm British. People say, no, you're not, you're American. I'm British. With an American accent. But yeah, on a conventional level, I'm British. Or on a conventional level, I'm American. Doesn't mean we start going around and saying, I'm nothing. I'm emptiness. That could be pretty annoying. Actually, really annoying. So then what do we do with it? So how do we work with it? So during this winter retreat, what I did, and I've only told Ajahn Pasano this, but I created a little flag that every time I saw myself becoming something, this identification with anything, whatever it was, whatever label I labeled myself, or being good at this or not good at this, or identifying myself, I would flag it. And this was when I was alone, either out walking or in my cabin. I would say I would make the sound ding. And this exposes my eccentricity, I guess. And fortunately, I haven't done it in public yet. But if you hear me say ding, then you know I was born psychologically somewhere. I've also learned how to do it internally. So, ding, born again. And I found it really useful because it brought it more fully into consciousness. And so it's interesting because sometimes I didn't realize that I'd formed this sort of bhava, this becoming, until sometimes a minute, two, three, four, five, 10 minutes later. I'd be sitting there in meditation and I'd go, oh, wow. It was in consciousness, but you didn't actually fully acknowledge it enough to do ding. So that's, I've found that really useful to use that. Oh. And so then I'd say ding. Just to really put a punctuation and just say, okay, look at this. Notice it. And not to form a self around that. And then not to beat you can create another self by saying, oh, you're hopeless. You've been a monk 10 years, still doing this. How many lifetimes have you been doing this? But just to see it, because once you see things, at least the way I'm more and more, the way I understand, is like that's like the first noble truth, that there is suffering. It's more like acknowledge. It's that acknowledgement, like there it is, there is this there. It's present. So if we just fully acknowledge and accept that that's happened or that's present, then even that. Is the beginning of letting go. It's when we start to either form another identity around it or cling to it or start, oh, I've got to get rid of this, instead of just going, oh wow, isn't that interesting that I'm forming an identity around such and such. Oh, Ahimsako, you're hopeless at doing such and such. Ding. I was just born as a hopeless at doing. Instead of just going, oh, well, that's just an inner thought. That's a reaction or a response to some idea of how you think you should be or shouldn't be. And it's I've been reading a book of talks by Ajahn Suchito, who's the abbot of Chithurst Buddhist Monastery in England, and he has this lovely use of language. I find it quite amazing, and he comes up with these images, and this he gave this image, you know, that when you know seeing things, you know, whatever it is, whether it's you know bhava tanha or something, is that it's a bit like you know when you're looking at your reflection in a pond, you know, a very still pond, and paraphrasing here, and this isn't exactly how he wrote it, but seeing your image, and then you know, let's say that's the sort of image that I have of myself as such and such a thing, and that's bhava tanha. But he says, as soon as you start poking in the water, the image starts breaking up. So that's like in meditation or in Dhamma practice. As soon as we start poking around and going, oh, no, you ding, oh, well, I'm poking around a little bit. And then it starts to soften, it starts to break up the reality of that thought, that idea of who and what I am. Oh, you're just prodding around. Oh, there's nothing really there. It's just an image. It's just that much. If I go like this, it disappears. You reach through it and you see that there's nothing there. It's just formed. It's temporary, not real. So the more we see that, the more we do that, and then that becomes our new habitual way of seeing. So then we start, instead of seeing with ignorance, we start to see the reality of these things. Oh, these are just ideas. Yes, I am I'm really good at doing such and such. I'm a very good computer programmer. But you're not, that's not who and what you are. It's just what you do. So instead of, in one way I like to look at it is instead of being somebody or something, we're just this collection that we call a human being doing. It's just a process. We're doing our best, trying our best, absolutely. Try our best. Do well, do good. Try our best. But then not grasping at that. Because if you do your best, but that's all we can do. If it doesn't work out, okay, we can learn from that. But we don't form an identity around that. Oh, I'm a useless person, or I'm a dreadful computer programmer. Therefore, I am a dreadful person. Most people know this on a rational level, but I mean, how many times do people, when they lose their job or lose some sort of position, you know, or all of a sudden get blamed? It's like that whole in the Buddhist teachings around praise and blame. You know, people praise you enough in something, you know, oh, you're really, really good at doing such and such. And you start to think, oh, wow, yeah, I'm good at that. And then we start to separate ourselves from people that might not be good at that. I'm good at this, they're not. And then all of a sudden somebody blames you and says, you know, you might hear either directly or indirectly, oh, somebody said you're really not very good at that. And you're thinking, no, I am. People say I am. And then all of a sudden it's that we start to feel stress because of what people say. And that's human. I mean, that's very much a part of it. But it's learning how to see through that as just part of, you know, that's just somebody's opinion. But if we're not holding tight to an identity, holding and grasping, then we just go, okay, well, fair enough. That's the way they see it. Maybe it's true. Maybe we should think, oh, well, yeah. Maybe that is the case. Maybe I'm not very good at that. But do I want to suffer over that? Do I want to hang on to that? Is my peace of mind, is that peace in my heart, my overall arching well-being based on what I do as a profession, or how those conventional things. And that's why, you know, if we live skillfully, like this evening, you know, people had the opportunity to formally request the 8 precepts. To formally do that. And that's a really helpful guideline for living in a way which is harmless. Especially the first few precepts, you know, that are more ethically, the ethically based precepts around killing, stealing, lying, and sexual misconduct. The other ones are renunciant precepts. Those are more around, you know, consciously not involving ourselves in things in order to simplify our life. So if we live in that way, then no matter how we live, that's why, like, the precepts are considered, you know, this sort of gift of fearlessness. It's called Abhayadana. So like Abhayagiri, fearless mountain. Abhayadana is the gift of fearlessness. And so not just to other people, because if we're acting skillfully, then other people aren't afraid, but it's also in our own heart. We don't have to live in fear in terms of our future births, whether they're psychological births in this human life or births in another body, another after this body dies. Don't need to worry, because we've done our best. If we've done our best, if we live skillfully, then even if we're born again, you know, if we do have another birth, then that will lead to skillfulness sooner or later. You know, skillful birth, good birth sooner or later. So, but yeah, it's just that seeing, you know, understanding. All right, just to see how we're forming. So, and it can be incredibly subtle. Bhavatanha, and then like I said, the vibhavatana, the opposite of trying to get rid of some sort of state of being, you know, trying to get rid of some identification. Oh, people see me as, I think people see me as being an angry type of person. God, I don't want to be seen as that. Now, of course, we don't want to be seen as that. But if we form this identity, if we actually believe that that our core being is angry, instead of maybe that just being a habit of reacting and responding with anger sometimes, if we see that as a true and fixed thing, then here again we're forming a self. We're forming a self around that. So. So much of the practice, that's what it's about. It's that really key, you know, the Buddha said, you know, that the end of becoming is Nibbana. So the end of bhava is enlightenment. And it doesn't mean, here again, it doesn't mean, as far as I understand, that we don't try, yeah, on a conventional level, you know, become a monk, and then in a couple of weeks, John and Doug, who's not here tonight, they will quote-unquote become Anagarikas. On a conventional level, yes, we are becoming this and that. But it's understanding and not taking that as an identity. And where we don't take that as an identity, then we just see it for what it is. This is a skillful convention. And then we don't suffer. We don't find that we're creating stress. So as we go about our day, whether we're in formal meditation practice, which is an incredibly useful way of seeing things rising, ceasing, because we've stilled, you know, we've really limited our sense impressions, or just going about our day-to-day activities, just to maybe, you know, take days or weeks or whatever, just just to see, oh, am I forming any identity around this? Where do I identify with myself? Am I a parent? Am I this profession? Am I a student? Am I a monk? And just to see if we're holding it tightly, maybe we're not. Because, and it changes. And going back just to close the talk, just going back to that image Ajahn Sucitto shared about, you know, our reflection in the water, and yeah, just the more we see things, you know, you're poking it. You know, when we see these things in our heart and mind, it's a little bit, that's the way I understand it. We're giving it a little poke, we're giving it a little jab, we're seeing, oh, we're touching it. Consciously touching that and going, okay, I see that, but oh. This is formed. It's not, yeah, it's starting to ripple. It's not solid. And then you start to see a more, probably a more spacious, more peaceful way of being when you see the lack of solidity of these things that feel so real. Because they do, they feel real. Pain, you know, pain is painful, but it's created. So I think that's enough for tonight. Mm-hmm.